Welcome back to CIY 104 FM. It is yours truly, Jerry Murray, and another week has gone by, and it is time for another installation of my show, Jerry's People. And at the outset, it is my first show of the new year. May I wish all your listeners a very happy, prosperous, healthy and peaceful new year. And thanks for your continued listenership throughout the past. I'm delighted to say kicking off the new year with a bang this year, because I'm joined in studio. My special guest this week is Dr. Rosary Griffin. Of course, not many of you wouldn't have heard of Rosary Griffin through the airwaves of CRY here. She's a regular contributor. She has her own show. She runs her show, alternate shows to mine, every second Wednesday night, The Perspective Show. And of course, you can also read Rosary's columns, regular columns on the East Cork Journal. And we're here to have a chat and no punches barred with Dr. Rosary Griffin. Rosary, thanks for dropping in.
You're very welcome. Rosary will do.
Thanks, Rosary, Jerry. Will do. I felt like I was in a surgery there for a moment. Thanks for dropping in, Rosary. It's lovely to chat to you the other side of the microphone for a change. Yeah. Tell us a bit about Rosary Griffin. You hail from?
Middleton.
Yes. And born and reared?
Middleton, mostly. I mean, I started life in Fermoy, I suppose up until I was 10, just outside Fermoy.
Okay.
We lived in my grandmother's pub, and that was a great upbringing in a way. A lot of community life, big into rural communities as a result. Grew up in the countryside, you know, all my friends were farmers, they were country people. We had a great school, a fantastic school, two-roomed school, you know, two teachers, so four classes per room, and fabulous education because it was so broad-based and no uniforms or any of that.
Did you have siblings, or do you have siblings?
I do. I have one brother and two sisters.
Okay, and where do you come in the pecking order?
Three.
You're number three.
I'm the one that apparently...
You're the lucky third.
I'm apparently the one that seeks attention all the time.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't think that's true. But anyway, we moved to Middleton when I was 10. And then I continued on Middleton, and I'm based in Middleton now.
And you mentioned, you know, community spirit and growing up in the country. Did that enhance or did it influence your outlook in life in a way?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. I suppose we had tremendous freedom growing up. Everybody talks about that now compared to, I suppose, children nowadays. We just, we're told get out or stay out until it's dark.
Yeah.
Before you tell a child that now, or go out and get some fresh air and don't be under my feet. So we're always out or doing jobs. My grandmother's pub, I had to do lots of jobs for her, like deliver papers, deliver the bread, clean the cigarette butted floor, clean and wash the glasses, the pub.
Because rural life was very much rural life, and you were looking after your neighbours and friends as much as your own family, weren't you?
Oh, absolutely, yeah, sure. It was.
But the difference in those days, you could leave the front door open or you could leave the key in the door.
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
It has changed drastically now, hasn't it?
Dishonesty, I think, was always there, though, you know, but I wouldn't want to think it's a new phenomenon, but it was certainly a bit more... a bit more relaxed that way, yeah.
Do you miss the rural upbringing? Do you miss the country life?
Well,
or do you regularly go back and visit?
Yeah, well, it was very definitely a strong part of my formation in terms of my love of nature, my love of the community, my love of community spirit and all that kind of stuff. And where I'm living now as well, I have, even though I'm close to the N25, you can't see it from my house. So when you look out the back, there's green fields. And when you look out the front, it looks like there's all green fields. So you wouldn't actually think that I was living. And that's what I always wanted. I always wanted to feel like, have the country feel, even though I'm...
Peace and tranquility.
Yeah, even though I'm only 2 minutes from town. Yeah.
And school, what way was school for you? Did you have subjects that you excelled in? Did you have favourite subject, favourite teachers? Or?
Yeah, good question. Like I said, my teachers in my primary school were absolutely amazing. They were very forward-thinking and liberal, and they got us involved in everything like, talent competitions, talk of the town, inter-school quizzes, all that kind of stuff. So gave us a very broad base in education. And again, I remember watching this slideshow that they brought up about oil, how oil... was a limited resource and we were using all the oil and we need to think of alternatives. Now, imagine this is, okay, I went to, this is in the early 80s, I'd imagine, late 80s. So, you know, they were so forward thinking already, you know, by any other name, they were talking about the environment at that stage.
Really?
And climate change. Well, it didn't go as far as climate change, but how oil was a limited resource. We had to think of alternative, you know, to be telling an 8-year-old.
Forward thinking.
That kind of thing at that age. It was just when I look back now, I just say, wow, they were really ahead of their time. You know, they were really fantastic.
Did you have a pet teacher or were you a pet to any of your teachers?
No, well, in that school, there was only two teachers. The senior teacher was very strict and the junior one wasn't. And I particularly liked the junior one, but she was good to everybody. You know, they didn't have favourites, which is really good. Okay. When I went to secondary in Middleton, St. Mary's High School, I excelled in English literature. English would have been my subject, really.
Okay.
English.
Surprise,
I liked history.
Surprise.
I know, yeah.
And was
Charlie
that
Hayes was a great history and geography teacher as well.
Okay.
Shout out there to Charlie. He was amazing. And my English teachers were great. But I used to love English anyway. And subsequently, I became an English teacher.
That's right. We'll come to that in a moment. But was there a big difference going to high school in Middleton? Some wonderful pupils have come out of there, of course.
Oh, yeah. Look, St. Mary's and Middleton were full of country girls as well, because they all came in from
the feeder schools.
So you had that country feel the whole time.
And was that a school of choice, or was it a thing that, was it a family thing, you automatically went to St. Mary's High School?
Automatically, because when I went to Middleton, I went straight into St. Bridget's, and from there it was the feeder school.
Okay.
Now, I did find a bit of a shock to the system, the religious.
Okay. That would have been big in those days, wasn't it?
Yeah, the religious, obviously the presentation nuns ran both schools, and that was a shock to the system. Not because my previous national school wasn't religious, they were very religious.
Right, but it was more enhanced and more in your face.
Yeah, I found it just, I don't know, and plus the uniform and the unisex aspect as well, they were all a bit of a shock to the system.
Right.
I don't know what I was expecting. And plus, I remember in my national school, there was always noise, you know, not noise, but there was always what I call a learning buzz in the background. Like, there was never silence.
Okay.
And then when I went to, you know, the primary school, all of a sudden there was silence in the class, you know, and you dare and talk. And I was saying, but learning is about talking, and it is about having a buzz.
Was that the fact that, without being too critical of the nuns, because
I'm not critical of the nuns, they did a great job.
That, you know, they ran the religious side of it more than the academic side of it, or?
They gave me a good formation in spirituality as well. I wouldn't be one bit critical of them. They did a fantastic job. You know, the nuns have always been.
Well, they obviously stood you in good.
No, they did. Look, like I said, it was just for me, coming from a country school. It's less about the nuns, but more about me, coming from a country school where you had a kind of a sense of huge autonomy.
At what stage in your formative years did you decide, you know, the route you were going to approach? Like, obviously, teaching was a big thing for you.
No, I didn't make any decisions, actually. I did my Leaving Cert in Carrick Tool, I have to add that. For me personally, I felt I wasn't progressing in St. Mary's at the time for various reasons. And so I went to St. Al's to do my Leaving Cert, and that worked out quite well. And so I ended up going to university just to do arts, but I really had no sense of what I was going to do in the future. Not really, no. I just thought I liked English and that was it. I thought maybe journalism. That had a huge attraction for me at the time. So I thought I'll do a degree in English and see where that takes me. Excuse me. Now, I went to DCU to see their course in journalism, and the students put me right off it, actually. They said, oh, don't do this course. There's no work in the area. None of us are working and blah, blah, blah. So they put me right off it, even though it looked very exciting, you know, because you'd radio and you'd television studios and you'd all the journalistic aspect. So then I just went back to UCC, and after I finished my degree, my mum kind of said, would you not consider doing the H-step in education, becoming a teacher? No, that was the furthest thing from my mind, I have to say, at that stage, to do the H-Dip. I thought, I really didn't see myself as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
But when I did it, I absolutely loved it.
I
was surprised, you know. I didn't think, and all my friends said, oh my God, like, what is the education system coming to if you're going to become a teacher? My God, there's
and
no
again,
hope for
was
our
there,
kids.
And again, was there a history of teachers in your family? Like,
no,
had
none.
Any of your siblings or anything?
Sorry, my mom taught in primary school, but in those days, when she taught, it was very informal. It just so happened that her own Leaving Cert was excellent. You know, in those days, you did, first of all, she did her Leaving Cert, which was a big deal in those days. And then she excelled in all her subjects. So she was kind of drafted into local primary schools to teach without a formal qualification. But then she went on to be a public servant in the Department of Agriculture, I think. And then, because of the marriage rule, when she got married, she had to leave the job. So she was debarred then, I suppose, from continuing work in the public sector.
But she still had the instinct and the know-how to advise you to go for teaching, which was great, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I was surprised because she obviously knew me better than I knew myself.
Never doubt a mother's instinct as this.
Exactly. Well, she always had a huge interest in education anyway, and always, I don't want to say pushed us, because to be fair, she never directed us per se. You know, she always let us up to each of us, and as a result, we all went off in diverse directions. But
so you received your qualifications. Where did that take you when you did your H-Dip?
Oh, I did my H-Dip, and then I was looking for a job, and I was getting subbing different places, but there was no full time work available at the time. The economy wasn't doing too well, so I ended up getting a research assistant post back in UCC. Okay. On a project called Multiple Intelligences, and that's looking at how people learn in different ways, which was kind of right into my barrow again. So basically, that it's not all about writing and arithmetic, and it's more about how people can learn through music, through bodily kinesthetic. You know, people are intelligent in different ways. They could be excellent sports people, or gymnastics, or you know. That
so
intelligence isn't a linear thing, it can be.
Just so that we're up to the mark here, you mentioned back in UCC. Did you do your studies for teaching in UCC?
I did my H-Dip, and then I did my H-Dip practice in St. Al's. I went back to St. Al's.
Okay.
And there, like when I was there as a H-Dip teacher, I put on Romeo and Juliet in Barry's Court Castle with the first years, and they loved that. And I got the other music teachers to do all the music as well to it. And
parents
loved it because they were able to use it. The little cottage had a coffee shop, so they went down there during the break. So it was a win-win for the owners of the castle, and it was a win-win for us because it was the ideal setting.
Did you really love the surroundings of UCC that much that you went back working there?
No, it was really necessity. There was nothing else kind of at the time. Like I said, it was difficult to get full-time teaching. That's what I would have wanted to have done full-time, but it wasn't possible. So I went back as a research assistant. I enjoyed the challenge. Of course, I got my master's through that research project anyway. And
researching what?
Multiple intelligences.
Okay.
So I was able to use my research to form part of my master's thesis. It was kind of a win-win for me.
Okay.
And they paid for my master's.
Oh,
so
very good.
So it meant that, and I got some kind of a stipend, you know, so I was earning while I was studying.
How many were in the class of that?
Oh, there was only two of us. There was only two researchers, myself and this other girl. Actually, it was thanks to the other girl that I got it, because we were both queuing up to be interviewed. And I hadn't a clue, to be honest with you. I had not an iota. And I said to her, do you have any clue about this Howard Gardner and multiple intelligences? And she had. So she told me all about it. And I said, oh, listen, that's fabulous. And the two of us ended up getting a job.
Really?
Yeah, so I owe the fact that I got the job to her. Siobhan. Barry, I think, was their second name, Siobhan.
Right. And
O'Many,
it sounds a fairly unique subject to be researching. Like, what did that entail on a daily basis for you as a student at that stage? Right.
Well, that subject, what it meant was I had to do lots of surveys of teachers and students. So my thesis was the theory of multiple intelligence, teacher practice and student learning. So it's basically how, if you adopted this theory about how people learn in different ways, how would this impact on your practice?
Okay.
So that basically, how did teachers then have to, I suppose, teach their lessons differently to accommodate all the children in their class with their variety of intelligences. So if you thought that people can be in, like, if you took on board the fact that people can be intelligent in many different ways, it means that you have to do things differently in the classroom. It can't be all talk and chalk.
Right.
Or bookwork.
Did you find when you were studying this as a researcher, did you find your personal upbringing in school, did that impact your thoughts and your...
Exactly. You just nailed it there, Jerry. What the philosophy did was actually confirm what I felt myself. So it was really very affirming from that point of view. So
that must have been a great advantage, was it?
Well, it was, because this is, I always felt this is what teaching should be about.
Yeah.
And as a result, when I was asked to do this project, sure, this project was talking directly to me. It was like, yeah, of course I believe this. Of course, this is what I think. This is the way it should be all the time. You know, learning, there should be a buzz in the classroom and learning. It can't be all about reading and writing and just. My kids go to Gaelscoil now at the moment, and they have very much, it's a mix, obviously, Gaelscoil's mix. It's bilingual, obviously. And I love the fact that they do so much, you know, there's so much extracurricular kind of activities that infiltrate the curriculum. And I think that's fabulous. It's a pity when it comes to secondary school that it changes a bit because it's exam driven, of course.
How many children do you have?
Two girls.
Two girls.
14 now. She's in second year in St. Mary's. And my other lady, Miriam, who I occasionally have on the show with me, is in sixth class.
Okay. Do you find, is there pressure on them now knowing what their mum has gone on to achieve?
I'd say they have no clue what I've done.
You know yourself?
No, I hardly know myself.
Looking at your studying for, you know, the multi-intelligences, intelligence, whatever.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, you're right.
Like, what, is there any one thing that you took from that, you know, seriously steered you towards this in future life?
Like
when you were studying this subject, was there any one thing or a group of things that said, right, this is where I want to be? Because you're back lecturing in this now, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. I'm teaching in the area. But from there, it didn't stop there. If it did, it might have been better, but it didn't stop there. Right. I gave a presentation at a conference on the area, and it so happened that the head of education from Oxford was attending the same conference, and we had a discussion after, and he invited me to go to Oxford to do my PhD under him in the department. So so then I spent 4 years at Oxford. I did my PhD and another master's while I was there.
Wow.
Well, the first year you had to follow this course about research methods. And if you wanted, you could pick it up as a degree if you did the thesis with it.
Yeah.
Of course, I thought, you know, here I'm at Oxford, 2 degrees for the price of one, why not? But sure, I had no idea the amount of extra work I took on was horrendous, you know. So I was really put myself under terrible pressure. But it worked out. And I did qualify with 2 degrees from Oxford, a master's.
Congratulations. Oxford must have been amazing, was it?
It was. It was, again, another culture shock. I wasn't.
Big difference to UCC.
Big difference to UCC. And just.
Did you miss home?
I did. You see, I was in these classes with a lot of international students because a lot of people would have got scholarships like I had. And, you know, I thought, OK, I'm coming from Ireland. I'm only going to England.
Rural
no big
Ireland.
Deal. Yeah, I said, no big deal. You know, we all speak the same language. It's, you know, it's going to be a cup of tea for me. I think I was the person who had the biggest culture shock there than all my European or international friends because they expected it to be different. Whereas I didn't.
Was the spectrum much different over there?
What do you mean?
In the thesis and everything, was it a continuation of what you had learned in UCC or had they a different approach? Did you find a difference in...
Yeah, well, obviously the classes when we were doing tutorials were a lot smaller, so we would have kind of seminar groups. So you'd have readings to do and then they would be discussed. So it was a lot more, I suppose, critical thinking. You know, you were really put on the spot a lot more. You had to have your homework done. You know, you could be put on the spot a lot. So that was quite challenging. And then on top of that, on top of getting my scholarship, I also had to earn money because Mm-hmm. Oxford was quite expensive. So I had two jobs as well. I had a weekend job that I would work in the pub, and I had a day job, which I did research in the department. I managed to pick up a research job. So I had two jobs as well as trying to get my academic work, you know, trying to keep on top of it, which was pretty tough. So it was a tough time. It wasn't easy, but
but now you're reaping the rewards, aren't you?
Well, I don't know would you say that, but I'm glad I did it. It was definitely a great experience.
Because of your experiences, and I'm going to play a bit of music now, give it time to take a breather, and we'll talk about where you are now and where you might have wished you were, right?
Yeah.
Because of your experiences, like, do you look at life as, you know, do you believe in the glass as half full or half empty?
Oh, I'm definitely glass half full person. I think everybody could look at their life and say it's half empty.
Right. But that's negative then.
But I mean, it's possible. Like you and I could have the exact same life. And, you know, what you make of it is how you look at it, really.
Because you sound like a lady that has been very, well, I suppose when I say fortuitous, I don't mean it in a degrading way.
Yeah.
But you certainly have landed on your feet a lot of times, haven't you?
Well, I suppose there's that would be the optics. There was, like, right, obviously a lot of hardship along the way.
But you make your own luck as well, don't you?
You make your own luck. And look, when opportunities present themselves, you have to go with
grab
it.
Them. Yeah.
You know. Like, and often they arise as a result of negative experiences, you know. They can happen just by default. You know, in a way, I didn't script out my life. There's no way I planned it the way it went. I would have been very happy to be a secondary school teacher from the minute I qualified. Right. I just wasn't successful in getting a full-time job. Okay. You know, they weren't there.
But you turned that into your benefit.
Well, I suppose the next thing that came along, what choice did I have? I had no money, I had no job, I had to get a job. So I just took the next thing which was the research assistant post. So, and that put me on another path.
Absolutely.
So it wasn't planned. No, nothing was planned.
Do you want to take a breather?
We'll take a breather.
You gave me a couple of songs there. I've down to four. In the Air Tonight, Phil Collins, Brown Eyed Girl, Ed Sheeran, Perfect, or Smells Like Teen Spirit. Shout.
I think we'll go with the Van Morrison one.
Brown Eyed Girl.
That represents my college years in UCC because it was always on in the background.
Are you brown eyed?
I'm not, but I loved Van Morrison.
Did he carry through many years and many hours of study?
I tell you what, he actually symbolises what college life was for me. Just, you know, good fun.
Okay. Do you want to introduce it yourself?
Van Morrison and Brown Eyed Girl.
Especially to my guest this evening, Rosary Griffin. I'm really enjoying it. Hope you're enjoying it too. We're going to play this specially for Rosary, and we'll be right back after the break. We're going to touch on where she is now, what she's achieved in life, and maybe a couple of humdinger questions like her pet hates, which I know she has none because she loves life. This is Brown Eyed Girl, especially for Rosary. Stay with me. We'll be right back after the break. Yeah, welcome back to part two of Jerry's People. And I'm delighted to say, Rosary, I've locked the door and she wasn't able to get out from the studio. And she's still with me in the studio. Rosary, thanks for staying with me.
My pleasure.
You're enjoying it?
I am. It's, you know, strange being on the other side of the mic. I'm normally the one asking the questions.
It is different, isn't it?
It is.
Rosary, let's you've had a wonderful upbringing. You've had a wonderful years of studying. You've come full circle. Now you're a working lady out there. You are a lecturer in adult education, and you're also a researcher in teaching and learning in UCC, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well done. Congratulations.
Oh.
How long have you been in these positions?
I joined UCC in 2003. So when I finished my doctorate, I went to Brussels. I did a postdoc. I got an EU scholarship. Did a postdoc there in ULB, the Université Libre de Bruxelles, because I also had French. And then I came back at that point to UCC. Again, I was still looking for secondary school teaching because I thought I'd still like to be a secondary school teacher. But anyway, I ended up getting a job at adult education, as I said. And I currently now, I've been, I suppose, working there as a researcher on two EU projects. I teach in disability studies. I teach research methods for anybody doing a thesis, you know, being it a dissertation or a master's or doctoral thesis, how to do the research and how to put it together. And I also have an abiding interest in global development issues because my PhD supervisor at Oxford was very big into the developing world. And as a result, I took a 3-year career break out, went to Limerick and became a director of a Centre for Global Development. And we held, we had a 1.5 or 1.8 million budget, and of which I had 6 research projects, and we went to Africa doing projects in Lesotho and Uganda. So that was, it was funded by Irish Aid.
Okay.
And we spent 3 years doing those projects. Basically, they were to assist the African countries improve their education system, improve their teaching, colleges of education to help people become teachers, and then to change and try and impact on the way in which they teach again. It was all rote learning, try and move away from that to a broader way of teaching, you know, going back to my theory of multiple intelligence, that, you know, try and, of course, they're limited by their resources. They're limited by the fact that they have so little, often just talk and chalk. But on the other hand, when I was in Africa, I learned an awful lot from the Africans about how you can do it with talk and chalk. You know, sometimes we're too reliant here in technology and all the gizmos, whereas they
and how
actually...
How long were you in Africa for?
Well, my projects went on for 3 years.
Okay.
But I wasn't there continuously. I was over and back, you know, because... So they were...
Was it a big culture shock in Africa? Like, were you very much back to basics? You talk about the talk and chalk. Was it very much back to basics in Africa? Or is it as poor or as remote or as destitute as we're led to believe?
Yes, it's all of the above. And I wasn't shocked, surprisingly, because I suppose we'd seen it through, you know, images of Africa through, you know, Ethiopia and the famine there and the kind of conditions. And yes, they do exist. And yes, people are that poor. Like when I went to Lesotho, people lived on what they called rondavels, which are mud huts. They're okay. Like the bohons we had during the famine years, only in African style, round with straw, you know, roofs.
Yeah.
And very basic. I mean, very little.
Did you need that at this stage of your life? Because
absolutely.
Coming from rural upcomings and upbringings to, you know, school, secondary school, thesis and everything under the sun, did you need a kind of a, you know, a culture?
No, I think, again, I suppose here I must give the nuns credit, you know, a very Christian upbringing, I suppose,
okay.
In terms of the sense of having to give back,
yeah.
The sense of that we need, if we're better off, we need to help people who are less well off. So very strong ethos of a global citizenship, really, that we should share what we have and try, if I can help people in any way, I mightn't be able to help them financially, but I might be able to help them upskill them, you know, teach them different ways of doing things. Helping them along. So that was very strong, I suppose. So, and plus I had 2 uncles on my father's side who were missionary priests.
They were
in Africa originally, in Nigeria before the Biafra War. After that, they were thrown out as a result of the civil war. And then they went to Brazil. And when they were in Brazil, I visited them there and I saw the kind of work they were involved in. So it was very much part of my upbringing as well, to look out for other people as best we can in whatever capacity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody...
And going back to my... Sorry, no, if I keep cutting the question, but
no.
I'm just conscious of time.
Time.
As well.
Yeah.
Going back to the glass half full scenario, did you, when you came back from South Africa, did it make you appreciate what we have more so here than, you know...
Yes. No matter how bad things were during the recession years, and things did get very bad for everybody, you know, I always was, you could just close your eyes and think, oh my God, what I have seen and what people have here and what people have over there, there's no comparison. I mean, no comparison. We have the luxury of running water. We have the luxury of a latrine in our house. We have the luxury of having shelter, proper shelter, clothing. We have the luxury of having food every day. I mean, they don't have those luxuries.
And we don't suffer persecution.
We don't suffer persecution. And if we are actually sick, we have a doctor to go to. In some of the places I was in, they have 1 doctor per 100,000 people.
Right.
I mean, you know, and even if you had the capacity to go to the doctor, if you had the money, you know, what's the chances of seeing the doctor, you know? So I know we think we have it bad here, and it's a different kind of pressure here.
But it has helped you, really, with your current position, hasn't it? It has taught you a lot in life.
Oh, yeah. Look, it gives you broader perspective, and it gives you a sense of, like, I always, when people are complaining about this and the other, I often think in the back of my head, that's a first world problem. You know, that's a first world problem. Yeah, and I often find myself saying it to myself.
Because you mentioned, you know, the straw houses and everything. In past employment, I worked for a timeshare exchange company in the city. And one of my supervisors went on a trip to, she was actually on honeymoon.
Right.
And they were going on one of these train trips through a shanty town, and she see all the poor people out there, and they had brought a lunch with them, a packed lunch, and she threw across the bread out to these, in passing through one of these shanty towns, and she nearly got scalded by the security on the train, because there was such a rush for the cross the bread that she was thrown out to them. It frightened her. It left a mark on her for life. And I suppose, going back to the glass half full, it certainly makes it sound like that, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Look, you always have to make the most of what you have and where you're at in life, and pick yourself up. I mean, there's nobody that doesn't have challenges in life and that have hardships. Everybody goes through hardships. And I mean, the best thing is, I often think, how can I teach my children resilience? I'm more interested in trying to build their resilience. And I do give them a hard time, my kids. You know, I don't.
That was a question I was going to ask you. Do your kids say, like, "Mam, you're not in college now, you're at home, you're our mother"? Do you find it difficult to marry, to successfully get through? You know, you've been lecturing in college. You're researching your teaching and learning skills. How do you marry the two, being obviously a loving and doting mother to your two children?
Loving and doting, they could contest that. I'm their mother. That's the only capacity they see me in.
Mother number one? Yeah.
Oh, mother number one. Yeah. No, and, I mean, as far as they're concerned, I'm pretty strict as well, I think. So, not in a bad way, but it's like they don't get their own way off. You know.
As a lecturer in adult education, what are your most challenging issues that you have to?
I teach in a disability studies group, and I find that very rewarding. I find it challenging to listen to their stories, because I really find it very upsetting that people who have already so much to deal with, either they work in disability or they have children who have disabilities, or they may themselves have a disability. And the fact that they have to fight for services really upsets me, because I feel that the services should be coming to them. And, you know, people should be coming and asking them, what can we do for you, rather than them filing endless paperwork for, you know, for the most mundane things, which they should automatically be getting. The state should really be trying to unburden these people and help them, rather than to be. So that I find that very upsetting. But they are the most rewarding group to work with, because I'm in total admiration of what they do every day. And they're so dedicated to their profession, or to their cause. Yeah, they're just incredible.
When you come home, you'll be delighted to know the interview is nearly over, and you're passing with flying colours, I might add. When you are on the way home from UCC in the evening, or when you're relaxing, do you ever relax? Like,
do you
ever reflect and say, is there something that you would, when you were growing up as a young girl in rural Ireland, was there ever anything that you thought you might have been, a nurse, a doctor?
No.
A mechanic?
No, none of the above. I just liked reading.
Okay.
That was my.
You were very academic from day one.
I wouldn't say academic, no. I was actually probably not very academic. And I think that's the thing, that I think I only became academic when I went to third level. I wasn't really academic.
So there was nothing else that you think you might have been better at?
A journalist. I thought growing up, maybe I'd like to be a journalist, maybe I'd like to be a writer. But really beyond that, I didn't have any great notions.
Is that why you write regular columns in the Eastport
Journal? Yeah, I enjoy that. I enjoy the challenge. And maybe someday I'll get to write a bigger book or something.
Is there a person nationally or internationally that that has seriously inspired you as a person?
Of late, Greta Thunberg. I think she's incredible. Plus, she's Asperger's, and that is why she's so incredible, because she's so clear in her message, and she keeps saying she keeps pointing to the science. Initially, I was a bit skeptical about her, but the more I heard her, the more I thought she is such an inspiration, and we need people like Greta. So she is the person of late. Prior to that, it was perhaps Mary Robinson or Nelson Mandela. These were great people.
of course, the African connection with Nelson Mandela.
Yeah, well, he was an amazing person. His story is incredible, and he was so forgiving, given all he went through.
If you were able, if the fairy godmother came in through the door there and granted you a wish to sit in a room with any one person or group, who would that one person or group be right now?
Believe it or not, I'd love to sit in a room with Donald Trump.
Really?
Yeah, I'd love it. I'd love to... I don't know, that man perplexes me, and I would love to put really difficult questions to him, although I don't know, could he manage them, but I would like to put...
He'd probably have to answer you in a tweet.
Perhaps, but I really would like, I don't know, I'm fascinated by him, he's such an extraordinary individual in so many ways. I'm still perplexed. I can't work him out. He's just very strange.
Do you have pet hates in life? Is there something that really... you mentioned Donald Trump perplexes you, but apart from Donald, are there things that really get under your gander?
Yeah, I didn't say I hate Donald Trump. I don't know the man to hate him, but what I've seen of him, it doesn't inspire me. But... let me see. I don't particularly enjoy being around negative people. I find they drain my energy, and I find I'm a solutions person. So if people have an issue, of course I'm happy to help them, but I want a solution. I want to help with problem solving, you know. So if they're looking for empathy or sympathy or whatever, that's fine, but they need to go to somebody else, like a counsellor or a friend or someone to cry on. Now, it's not that I'm not open to that, but I'm more interested in helping people. So if you have a problem and you come to me, I'm interested only in finding a solution to your problem.
You're a problem solver.
I'm a problem solver, but I wouldn't say my strength is in listening or empathising with people, although I do have huge empathy for people, but I really want to get to the next stage, is how can we fix this?
I'd say no or can't are big no words in your vocabulary.
They don't exist. There's always a way around everything.
No,
I always think
can't.
This.
Yeah, yeah.
No, there's always a way. There's always a way. You just have to find it.
When the time comes for Rosario to be taken from this life, and I hope it doesn't happen for a long, long time yet, how would Rosario Griffin like to be remembered?
Well, Rosario Griffin was at death's door before. I don't know, I probably mentioned it. I certainly did in an article that I had cervical cancer and I had stage 3. And I was, the operation was touch and go. And it was, so I was at that place. I guess for me, being at that place, the most important thing I learned was, obviously the operation was successful and the outcome was positive. But I think is you have to live your life as best you can. I mean, live it to the maximum as best you can. We've only one shot at it. It's so easy. It could be so easy not to bother getting up in the morning, or to give up. I mean, everybody goes through hardships of different types, but you just have to keep going. You just have to keep going. Dust yourself down and keep going and make the most of life. So, I don't think I'm not frightened by death. How would I like to be remembered? I think I'd like to think that I made a difference. You know, that I made a difference in whatever capacity that is, I don't know, but I'd like to think that I made a difference in people's lives.
Well, you certainly inspired me today.
Oh, thank you.
And I hope our listeners will come away with the same feeling from tonight. Would you rather be remembered by your children first and your students after, or obviously that's a silly question, yeah?
No, I treasure my friends and my family, obviously. My family are always first. And I make sure I have time for my friends and my family, and they're the most important thing to me. After that, then I don't really care too much. You know, I mean, my work is my work. I enjoy my work, and I hope I'm good at it, and I like to, I give it my all. But ultimately, when I go home, I want to be with my family, and I want to be with my friends, and that they're the only people that matter to me, really, at the end of the day.
How do you manage to sit down and relax, or is there a switch off in your life?
I think I go to bed every night at 9 o'clock. I at least I start preparing to go to bed at 9 o'clock. and I tried to be in bed for 9 o'clock. It's a discipline I got into.
Do you read a book or do you?
I usually watch current affairs. I love politics, so
you're in the right place now, aren't you? But we won't even go there because that's another show.
Yes, indeed.
Do you miss the cut and thrust? Because I know you did delve in politics for a while. We won't get into it too much.
We can't.
Do you miss the cut and thrust of that, or is it something that you'll still be aligned to forever?
I've always been interested. I have family in politics. I have an uncle who is in one party. I have cousins in other party, and I'm very involved from that point of view. But
do you see yourself entering back into the political field?
Maybe. The only thing is, when I did dip my toes in the water, it is very time consuming, and I am conscious that my kids are still young, and I definitely want to prioritise them. So the time perhaps wasn't right for me, and that's okay. Maybe I will, maybe I won't, I don't know. I'm open to all possibilities, but I will say I do prioritise my family and I do prioritise my friends, and they're the most important thing to me.
Great stuff. Rosaria, I really, really, really enjoyed our chat.
I hope you've
enjoyed it too.
I have, Jerry. You caught me by surprise when I got the invitation.
For those of you who are listening on the radio, you should see Rosaria blushing here. I must have done something right. 1,000 million thanks for taking the time out to share your life with me.
You're welcome.
I don't think I made you feel too uncomfortable.
No, it was wonderful. Thank you, Jerry. Yeah,
thank you very much.
Pleasure
for
as usual.
Sharing that. And
thank you.
We'll give you one more song before we go. We have Perfect from Ed Sheeran. Now, I know you mentioned the one...
We Are the World?
Yeah.
No, that's okay. I'd prefer Ed Sheeran and Perfect.
Ed Sheeran. Is there a reason you picked this one?
I think it's about love.
Okay. Is there a love in Rosaria's life?
Currently, yes.
Okay. Especially to the love in Rosaria's life. This is Ed Sheeran and Perfect. It's been a blast, lads. My thanks to Rosaria for coming in and sharing her life with us today. I hope you've enjoyed listening to it. I certainly have enjoyed sitting here. And it's been a blast. Thanks to you, the listeners. Thanks to Paul and the technical support crowd outside. Thanks everyone to Dara Parker for allowing us have this show. I believe it's wonderful. I'm really enjoying it. And thanks to everyone for listening. And looking forward to 2 weeks' time, and I'll be back. I have a very special guest coming up in 2 weeks' time. We'll talk to you then. Until then, share the love. Bye.